Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor, as today we talk about the optimal management of colorectal cancer with Dr. John Strickler from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. We have a great faculty for this series, and later on we'll show you the results of a survey we did of the faculty of their usual treatment practices. As always in our webinars, if you have any cases or questions you'd like to run by us, just put them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. And we also put out a very brief one-minute survey at the beginning and end of this conference. If you take it, you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We'll learn a little bit about you. We're getting ready to head out to Tampa for the SGO meeting. We're doing two symposia there, but we're also going to be putting them live online if you want to check it out. This coming Sunday, 11:45 a.m., we'll be talking about ovarian cancer. And then on Monday, we'll be talking about endometrial cancer. And everybody's looking forward to the two big phase three trials there. First-line therapy metastatic disease, IO plus chemotherapy. Where have you heard that before? Everybody's really curious to see what that's going to show. We're going to do another program actually next week. It's a follow-up to our GU symposium on prostate cancer. And then we'll be doing a program on April 4th on AML and MDS, reviewing what's going on over the past year. We'll finish out our ER-positive triple-negative breast cancer series on April 12th with Dr. Hurwitz. And then we'll do another year-in-review program on April 13th, looking at immunotherapy, another non-targeted approach to lung cancer. We know a lot of you end up listening to the webinars. If you're into the podcast, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Schroff. But today we're going to talk about colorectal cancer with Dr. Strickler. As always, we have a bunch of cases from general medical oncologists and community-based practice that we'll be presenting here today and get some feedback. We're going to start out with a little bit of an intro and kind of an overview of the field. And we're going to spend most of our time talking about these cases, how the faculty manage these situations, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about a few of the papers that John has done in our journal club. And as always, we have a bunch of other papers in the appendix for your reference. But John, I just want to start out with this sort of epic review article in the JCO on the topic of metastatic colorectal cancer. And audience, 22 pages of just dense stuff. I mean, a lot of stuff. You know, way more than what you see, I think, in the NCCN guidelines. But incredible effort that your team, the team there, put together, John. And I'm going to ask you to kind of refer back to it as we go through this. Any thoughts about this? It seemed like an incredible. The amount of data you all put in there was amazing. I mean, the recommendations was great, but the data and the references are incredibly valuable.
Absolutely. And you're right. You definitely want to set aside some time if you're going to read that in one push. You know, I think that what I like about this guideline is that there is some additional information in there that can be helpful, particularly around, say, perioperative management of patients. There's a lot of real world issues that many of us face around when to give chemotherapy in the metastatic setting when patients are still being treated potentially with surgical resectable disease. There's some interesting details around that. I think that it's a nice it does fill some gaps, I think, that we have from NCCN guidelines.
So I just saw a case pop into the chat room. Starts out 32 years old, pregnant woman, 19 weeks pregnant. We'll get to that in a second. But first, also just by way of introduction, this is another paper that you did in JAMA Oncology. And we'll talk later. We have a case of HER2-positive colorectal cancer. But I love the graphics in this. And actually, you were telling me, I was curious where they came from. And I guess you made them up. But in any event, this first one here is just kind of an overview of really biomarkers and targeted therapy. Any sort of broad, you know, we're going to get into a lot of specifics here, but you got a few other things, NTRK, et cetera. Any sort of comment you want to make about, first of all, you know, looking for biomarker testing nowadays in both in the upfront, localized setting and metastatic disease. Anything you want to say about this graphic?
Well, I think that the one of the struggles of the field in general, it's a struggle with oncology, is that we've got a rapidly changing treatment landscape, and actually the definition of an actionable biomarker has evolved tremendously in recent years. And it's hard to keep up with that. And we wanted to boil down the biomarkers, at least at the time this was published in 2022. We wanted to boil these biomarkers down in a way that was easy to remember, easy to refer to, and not make the reader overwhelmed with a bunch of information. You know, what are the key biomarkers I need to know that could potentially influence the management of metastatic colorectal cancer? And so there's just basic information, I think, that makes it very accessible to everyone.
I was just thinking, we were talking about this 22-page review article on metastatic colorectal cancer. When they sent me the original slide deck for me to go through for you, we had 214 slides. Obviously, we couldn't get into it, but just really a reflection of how much stuff there is to consider. These are the, I've never seen graphics like this before. I really like the way. Can you explain kind of, first of all, how you came up with the idea to do the graphic and how you read this?
Yeah. So this graphic was inspired by what I had seen in lung cancer realm. So one of my responsibilities here at Duke University is I co-lead the molecular tumor board. And as you know, there are a tremendous number of actionable biomarkers in lung cancer, and they have accumulated evidence around response rate and PFS. Sometimes it can be hard. You know, I've got all these drugs for ALK and for ROS and for these other actionable biomarkers. How does the response rate for these therapies line up? How does the progression-free survival line up? And then the size of the circle represents how many, the end of that study that led to that data. So it's a nice reference to get a sense for, okay, light blue is MSI high. This is the data for nivolumab, pembrolizumab, and ipi-nivo. And you can see that grid on objective response rate below and progression-free survival above to get a sense for level of clinical activity.
And I like how you say this is just in 2022, because things are changing so fast that the numbers are all moving around. But I just like the way you did it. And I guess the size of the circle represents the amount of data or number of patients?
The N of the trial, yeah, that we use to cite right. This data. So the smaller circles, the smaller circles you have less confidence in. And this one is really geared towards lining up the data around anti-ERBB2 agents. And in fairness, this was published in 2022. And if we were to do this chart again, it would look a little different. You know, you'd see TDXD and tucatinib trastuzumab really side by side with respect to response rate, though PFS would probably be a notch higher for tucatinib trastuzumab on this chart.
Yeah, you got to figure out a way to compare waterfall plots too, and this fancy way of doing indirect comparison. All right, we're going to get into some real cases. Before we get into real cases that I have prepared, let me give you a couple from the chat room that just sort of popped up. First from Dr. K.S. Kumar, who's a doc with the Florida Cancer Specialist. 57-year-old patient with rectal cancer, total neoadjuvant therapy, surgery, local regional recurrence, Lynch positive Lynch, got Pembro, good response for over a year, and is an excellent PR on Pembro, develops a seizure, mass in the left frontal region of the brain, GBM resected, getting Temodar and radiation therapy. He wants to know, should you keep the Pembro going?
Wow, that's a tough one.
That's an easy one for you, John, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I have an unfair advantage in this. I happen to work across the hallway from a world-class brain
right.
and spine center.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, you know, I walk across the hallway and I say, look, you know, tell me about Pembro for glioma and what you're planning to do and whether there's any concern for, you know, synergistic toxicity. I mean, ideally, we like to – you'll hear different things from different people. We like to get the Pembro at least a year in. Ideally, we shoot for 2 years. But if the Pembro would be in any way a problem with respect to management of the glioma, I would feel comfortable stopping the Pembro after a year and just continuing close surveillance.
Okay, let's try one more. I'm almost hesitant to do this one from Uzoma, but 70-year-old with stage 4 right-sided CRC, RAS wild type, has an acute CVA during the first cycle of full Fox Bev. Bev is stopped. Cardiac evaluation notes a PFO. Is that a patent, foramen, or valley?
Yeah.
Yes. That was closed. But the patient progressed on FOLFIRI, anti-EGFR therapy. The doc wants to know, would you try Bev again with TAS-102?
Well,
or Bev. The issue is Bev.
Yeah, the issue is Bev. And what I think the safety issue here is that bevacizumab does double your risk of heart attack or stroke if you look at the historical evidence. And that's fine if the risk is low. But I think in somebody who has had, you know, a recent prior history of a heart attack or stroke, that risk may be too great. And of course, we're overlaying that concern against the absolute benefit. And the absolute benefit of having Bev to TAS is rather modest here, in the range of a couple of months. So I think given the risk-benefit trade-offs, we've got in a very challenging situation, I would favor TAS-102 by itself.
All right. Well, let's get into some of the cases that we have prepared. We're going to start out with Dr. Gandhi, another doc in the Florida Cancer Specialist, 74-year-old woman with metastatic colon cancer. I picked this case to get started, not just because of the oncologic specific issue of MSI high what this patient had, but also the human side of oncology and what this oncologist actually experienced with this woman who had metastatic disease, started first-line chemotherapy, did not do well, progressed. The patient did not want any more treatment, very advanced disease, went into hospice. But as it rarely and occasionally happened, things of interest occurred. Here's the case.
She presented to me in 2016. That time, really MSI high, we did not know too much about it 7 years ago. I gave FOLFIRI, she had significant diarrhea, she stopped it. I read one article that was like 20, 30 cases with Pembro, and I said, okay, I'm going to try on her. After she failed FOLFIRI, she was in so much bad shape, she wanted to go on hospice. Actually, she elected to go on hospice, and then I read the study on Pembro, and we had a good personal relationship, so I called her. I said, I want you to get out of this drug and try this Pembro. And she reluctantly agreed. That was like 2017. So now it is almost 6 years. And she's doing very, very well. And we always continuously talk to her. Should I stop Pembro? Should I continue Pembro? There are some research that you can stop after 2 years. So that's my major question. And God forbid, but if her cancer progresses, what do we give in this? Should I give him like a EP-NEVO kind of regimen?
So before we get into sort of the specific oncologic questions, just to take a breath back, we know a lot of people who use our programs are new to oncology. We have a lot of fellows watching. Any thoughts about the human experience? I don't know if any other part of medicine that people have it. Of course, this is not every day. Any thoughts about just the human story here, John?
Well, I think what this case illustrates from Dr. Gandhi is what so many of us experience, which is that, you know, these are not just patients to us. They're people who matter to us. And whenever we're looking at data or hearing new things from colleagues or listening to your webinar, we've got that patient in the back of our mind that we want to help. Like, maybe I should try this for my patient. You know, these people put their trust in us, and we take that seriously, and we're always thinking of new ways to help. You know, I know there are many dedicated oncologists listening today, and I've seen some of my own patients in the hospital today that, you know, I'm trying to think of ways to help them. And so it just shows that we just never stop trying to think of ways we can improve the lives of our patients.
And so in terms of the specific issues, you know, one thing I was curious about, and we're going to get into the issue of ctDNA, but, you know, of course, in every time, every cancer where you use checkpoint inhibitors, you have situations where people are doing great, and the question is whether to stop or not. I mentioned the SGO meeting. We've got a case in the SGO of a patient who was just getting to 2 years. I think it was MSI endometrial, and they were talking about quitting, stopping, and the patient recurred. which is, you know, everybody's nightmare. Any comments about what you do in terms of duration of therapy and patients are tolerating treatment well? And what about ctDNA and to try to determine that? I mean, and do you approach it differently, the patient as a PR or CR?
Well, I think no two tumor types are the same. And I think we need to put that into context, that my answer here may not be applicable to, say, a gynecologic malignancy. That said, when you look at the PFS and overall survival for patients with MSI-high disease, predominantly colorectal cancer, who receive checkpoint inhibitor therapy, you see a flattening of those PFS and overall survival curves right around the 12 to 18 month mark. And it does not appear that, while it is possible to progress after that 12 to 18 month mark, it's rare. And that flattening of that curve occurs whether you continue the immunotherapy or not. So while there's no evidence to support this practice, and we don't know the exact duration we need to give treatment, my practice is to stop at 2 years. And I do have this growing pack of patients, much like Dr. Gandhi's, who are alive, disease-free, with no evidence of disease, 5, 6, 7, 8 years out. You know, it's tremendously rewarding to see somebody who's sick on the verge of hospice, who has the chance to see their kids, their grandkids grow up with a therapy that in many cases has minimal toxicity. And, you know, you raised an interesting point about circulating tumor DNA. This is something that's entered the clinic more recently. And that could be used also to decide whether you stop or not as well. But I would be pretty surprised if you detected circulating tumor DNA in most of these patients after a year of immune checkpoint blockade, so long as you were seeing radiographic response.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. If anybody in the chat room's ever done that, I'd be real curious to hear about it. We, in terms of the faculty survey of MSI High, because he was asking about Ipi-Nivo, and most of the faculty is on board for Pembro, but interestingly, two of the people, Dr. Overman and Deming, are saying in a fit patient, particularly, they might think about Ipi-Nivo. Any thoughts about that? That's a kind of a, you know, obviously you're going to see more toxicity, they're saying, right, younger patients. You ever do that up front?
I have on occasion. This one goes back to that grid that I showed earlier of the progression-free survival and the response rate. Clearly, you get a bump in terms of response rate with the Ipi-Nivo. I think you also get a bump in terms of your PFS. It's unclear to me from the current data whether you get also a bump in overall survival. That's not completely worked out yet. And I do believe we have a substantial increase in toxicity when we do dual checkpoint blockade. So when you consider that we don't have the same quality of evidence for Ipi-Nivo that we do for Pembro, which had that large international randomized phase 3, KEYNOTE-177, showing the superiority of Pembro over chemotherapy, I think the general default is to use pembrolizumab. However, I would consider ipilimumab and nivolumab in cases where that response rate is really critical to outcomes.
So I'm not sure how much data there is on his question about Ipi-Nivo in a patient who previously had single agent, but it looks like at least the faculty is on board to consider trying it. Is that something you do? And do you usually want to see some other therapy first and then you come to Ipi-Nivo, or you go right from Pembro to something like Ipi-Nivo?
Well, you know, I think my first preference is that if there is progression, is this maybe an oligoprogressive situation? Maybe one spot, right, in one location, what I would sometimes call a rogue lesion that we could potentially ablate or resect? Because there have been on occasion times where there has been a rogue lesion that's progressed through anti-PD-1 therapy and we're able to resect or ablate it and then continue that durable response to immune checkpoint blockade even without escalating to Ipi-Nivo.
All right, we're going to get into a couple of adjuvant cases, but before we do, this one popped up in the chat room from Dr. Ghazal, 32-year-old woman, 19 weeks pregnant, rectal adenocarcinoma, stage 3, does not want to terminate the pregnancy, had surgery, T3, N2, M0, 4 of 15 nodes positive, ? How to approach adjuvant therapy, particularly in relation to her pregnancy?
Yeah, these are some of the toughest issues we face in the clinic. I think that the later in the pregnancy that there is, I think we feel more and more comfortable giving things like FOLFOX. Certainly, you know, as you get into third trimester, we get more comfortable with that. The pathology report, as it's been described, is associated with an exceptionally high risk of recurrence, and I think that will influence that decision of how hard we're willing to push the chemotherapy in that setting. And also, circulating tumor DNA may influence that decision of, you know, how hard to push with the cytotoxic chemotherapy. You know, very delicate balance, and it involves a very elaborate discussion with the patient to discuss risks and benefits and trade-offs.
So usually when we present these cases, like half of them are under age 50, but maybe that's because people want to present cases like that today. Most of them are older. But any sort of hypotheses, personal hypotheses about why we're seeing this increase in younger patients?
It's only speculation from my part. It's clearly a rising health crisis in the country. I know, as in my clinic, I have far too many people under the age of 50 with metastatic colorectal cancer, and we don't know why. Could be some type of environmental stimulus that we just haven't figured out yet. Some have speculated on the use of antibiotics, heavy use of antibiotics potentially changing gut microbiota and how that may influence, what the development of malignancy later on. But I wish I had an answer to it. I just don't at this point.
All right. Well, let's see a couple of adjuvant cases. This is a 77-year-old man, a patient of Dr. Azzi.
Pathologically, he was a T3, N0, LVI was positive, no perineural invasion. All the margins were negative. Lymph nodes were examined, 17 were negative. And I did get MRD testing with a tumor-informed circulating tumor DNA assay 4 weeks after the colectomy, and that was negative. The patient is interested in skipping chemotherapy if possible. And I was interested to see if our faculty are using MRD testing in their clinic and would they consider it in any decision making, especially in kind of, you know, gray zone areas where you could possibly, per NCCN, consider capecitabine or consider observation or consider chemo. Treatment de-escalation in patients with stage 2 specifically, but also stage 3. And I think also some of our older patients with rectal tumors sometimes are interested in kind of a watch and wait approach after chemo radiation if there's been any use in that scenario.
Mm-hmm. So number one question from general medical oncologists about circulating DNA, particularly in the adjuvant situation of colorectal cancer. You know, we talk about it with the investigators all the time. You know, you guys are using it all the time. The docs in practice are like, tell me what to do here. So any thoughts about this case?
I think that this is probably the ideal case for a tumor-informed circulating tumor DNA assay. And there's a few reasons for this. I think, first, there is not an established evidence-based standard on how to manage T3 N0 microsatellite stable colon cancer in the adjuvant setting. There's no proven survival benefit to giving adjuvant chemotherapy, and yet we often give it. We oftentimes use clinical risk factors, things like lymphovascular invasion, to guide the use of adjuvant chemotherapy. But once again, no survival advantage. There's no advantage to escalating to FOLFOX in this particular scenario. And the risk here is that we're over-treating someone who has an 80 to 85% chance of being cured based on surgery alone. The DYNAMIC trial, which was conducted in Australia and published in New England Journal, presented at ASCO, took patients just like this one and randomized patients to either ctDNA-guided management or to standard risk factor-based treatment. And if this patient had been randomized to standard risk factor-based treatment, he would have gotten adjuvant chemotherapy for 6 months, probably 5-FU or capecitabine. If he had been assigned to the ctDNA-guided arm, he would have been assigned to no treatment. And in this trial, they found that you were half as likely to receive chemotherapy if you were on the ctDNA-guided arm, and the two-year relapse-free survival was identical. So I think that there is mounting evidence that in cases such as these, where you're on the fence about adjuvant chemotherapy, you could potentially use a circulating tumor DNA test to break the tie and make that decision.
So we're getting so many comments and cases in the chat room. We may not get to the data, but the dynamic trial and a bunch of other studies are in the slide deck. We just really wanted to talk about it. And let me just bring in one other case sort of at the other end of the spectrum, and then we'll chat a little bit more about some of the data behind this. This is an 80-year-old woman, stage 3C disease. Dr. Chen.
This is a very nice 80-year-old woman. She had presented with a T4A N2B stage 3C adenocarcinoma of the colon with high-risk features. Pathology demonstrated adenocarcinoma with neuroendocrine features. It was poorly differentiated. It was 7 centimeter, and the tumor invades through the visceral peritoneum. Margins were clear, and there was evidence of lymphovascular invasion and extramural vascular invasion. 18 out of 32 lymph nodes were involved. So she was treated with adjuvant chemotherapy with FOLFOX and completed 12 cycles. Given her really high-risk disease, one question would be, is there any data for additional treatment after this? And also, what is the role for circulating tumor DNA for surveillance, and how would that impact treatment?
And, you know, I don't know if you view this as an adjuvant or metastatic case, but what would you say the baseline risk for recurrence is here?
Extremely high risk of recurrence. Yeah. I can't quote an exact number, but certainly even after adjuvant chemotherapy, I would say well greater than 50% risk of recurrence.
So how about her questions about, is there anything else that can be done and whether there might be a role for ctDNA? And I'll add, are there any trials looking at this situation?
Yeah, we'll start with the trial question. There is a very interesting study that was launched out of Massachusetts General Hospital. So Ryan Corcoran and Aparna Parikh have a very interesting study where they take patients with high-risk stage 3 disease who complete adjuvant chemotherapy, and then they will do a circulating tumor DNA test after the completion of adjuvant chemotherapy, and then they have various interventions planned if there's a positive result. And I think this would be a perfect patient for that kind of a trial. The concern I have about circulating tumor DNA in practice for a case like this is that this is an 80-year-old woman who's now completed 6 months of FOLFOX. She's probably feeling pretty tired and worn out from 6 months of continuous FOLFOX. And if we get a positive circulating tumor DNA result, I don't know, I don't feel like we do have a strong evidence base for what to do next for her to mitigate her risk. Clearly, that would be a sign that she's at extremely high risk for recurrence, and it would be just a matter of when. But I don't know if she would even be able to handle something like FOLFIRI, you know, early, as you know, before something's even evident on a scan. So I'm careful about ordering the test in scenarios where I wouldn't know what to do with the result, and it might force some tough decisions on the patient and cause a lot of anxiety, but not actually improve that person's well-being. So that this might be a scenario where I'm less enthusiastic.
Yeah, that's a general principle in oncology and medicine, I think, about ordering tests. So I want to take a look at the faculty approach to this. But first, Dr. Rudolph in the chat room wants to know, is a one-time ctDNA assay 4 weeks post-surgery sufficient to make decisions?
That's a wonderful question. So when you take that single postoperative time point, this came out of the Japanese GALAXY study, which they published in January. So they looked at 1,000 patients with stage 1 through 3 disease. That single postoperative time point, 4 weeks post-op, and it's positive, tenfold increased risk of recurrence as opposed to for those patients who have negative circulating tumor DNA at that one time point. However, there are some patients who are negative that still recur. I think the general sensitivity that we think about for recurrence at that single postoperative time point is maybe upwards of 70%. That means we might be missing 1 in 3 recurrences off that one time point. So I would not totally rest easy if it comes back negative at that first postoperative time point, but it certainly does point to a much better long-term outcome than for those patients who are positive.
So we asked the faculty in what situations they're using ctDNA and specifically Signatera in the adjuvant situation. Everybody, as you said stage 2, but a number of people, including you, say other situations. And I guess the one thing I hear a lot about is the patient with like one node and whether you can use it there. What are some of the situations outside of stage 2, incidentally?
Yeah, I think they're... It's really when you bring these into the clinic, we're using them in all kinds of scenarios that are not really testable by trial. So a classic scenario for me would be that CEA value that's persistently high, causing tremendous anxiety in the patient. The NCCN guidelines say in a persistently elevated CEA, we should be doing a PET scan for these patients. I would say that that may be overscanning, and you can potentially de-intensify surveillance in these circumstances if you get negative circulating tumor DNA back. Another scenario where I've used it is this debate between 3 versus 6 months. So you brought up the case, you know, what if there's one node? Well, our standard would be 3 months of full FOX or CAPOX, but certainly a circulating tumor DNA that's positive may suggest a more aggressive approach. So I think there are all kinds of different creative ways we could apply this technology. And many of us are already doing this in the clinic.
So I'm not sure we're going to get to the case where we have a patient who had a liver met resect. Actually, his next case does too, but
okay.
The doc was asking the question. There's another case where a hepatic met was resected and question of ctDNA in that situation. So stage 4 NED.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so stage 4 NED is one of the toughest scenarios we have in colon cancer. Our clinical practice, which is based more on momentum than by evidence, is to give adjuvant chemotherapy frequently. Most of the evidence around adjuvant chemotherapy is with FOLFOX, and the NCCN guidelines will recommend a total of 6 months perioperative FOLFOX. So if you got 3 months before surgery, you'd get 3 months after. That's based off an ERTC study that showed a PFS benefit but no survival benefit. In recent years, a Japanese cooperative group published their JCOG study showing no survival advantage to the use of adjuvant FOLFOX after resection of a liver metastasis with curative intent, and in fact, there was a trend towards harm, despite the fact there was a disease-free survival benefit. So we are doing oftentimes adjuvant chemotherapy, but it's not well-rooted in the evidence.
So let's talk a little bit about HER2 positive disease. I'm going to let you define what that is in a second. And of course, there's a lot of interest in metastatic disease, and particularly the presentation you did last summer at the ESMO GI meeting that I have to say shocked me and shocked a lot of people at the efficacy that you reported there with tucatinib and trastuzumab in the Mountaineer study. This is a patient who actually presented with what looked like potentially a resectable disease. The only thing that made it different was the fact that it was HER2 amplified, although I think Dr. Viswanathan treated the patient the same way either way. But here's the case.
CARIS testing showed HER2 amplification, BRAF unmutated, KRAS unmutated, and MSI stable disease. So my thought was, since he's young and he doesn't have a big burden of disease in the liver, can I give him chemotherapy and resect these liver lesions and give him a chance at cure? So that's the discussion I had with the surgical oncologist. They agreed. We gave him 6 cycles of FOLFOX CD. He had excellent response, a significant decrease in the size of the liver lesion, and had resection, and finished adjuvant chemotherapy for 6 months and is currently on surveillance. He's almost 2 years out with no evidence of disease. You know, every time we scan him, we have this moment of anxiety and a sigh of relief after, okay, so far doing well.
Did you think about adding in trastuzumab?
No. It's a good question, actually. I didn't think of that. I don't know if routinely my colleagues are doing that.
So sometimes when people are presenting cases to me, I forget what kind of cancer they're talking about. I'm thinking HER2 positive, you got to get a response. Why not add trastuzumab? But I'm sure there's no data. Just kind of curious what you would have done in this situation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We don't have data that anti-HER2 therapies add value in this particular scenario. Presumably it would be FOLFOX-IRI with trastuzumab. That's just not a regimen that's been studied to date. One of the goals that we have in the near future is to begin to study this by bringing tucatinib and trastuzumab, which is now FDA approved for HER2-positive colon cancer, together with FOLFOX. We'd love to see that report out positive to at least justify pairing those that combination together. But I do think we would be practicing ahead of the evidence to incorporate an anti-HER2 regimen in this scenario.
So easy question. How do you define HER2 positivity in colorectal cancer? Just kidding. Not that straightforward, but maybe you can talk a little bit about that and contrast it to the way we approach breast cancer, particularly upper GI cancer, which I find very interesting. The upper GI people, I don't know whether you do it, the patient may start out HER2 positive, but then they'll do a liquid biopsy. If it's HER2 negative, they won't use HER2 therapy, which people don't do in breast cancer. But anyhow, how do you define HER2 positive colorectal cancer? And do you repeat it once it's positive with liquid biopsy?
So I define it the same way the FDA defines HER2 positive colon cancer, and that is by any assay you choose. There is no standardized IHC and FISH criteria for colon cancer. There was a proposed IHC and FISH criteria out of Italy, but it's not been broadly adopted or validated in the United States. In truth, in real world practice, most patients with colon cancer are receiving an NGS test at the time of diagnosis, presumptively to look for KRAS, NRAS, BRAF, MSI, and HER2 is included in those panels, and that's usually how we are diagnosing HER2 positive disease. I still like to order IHC and FISH on patients with HER2-positive colon cancer, and our pathologists at my institution are generally using the gastric criteria. There is a difference in terms of the type of staining pattern you get with colon cancer compared to, say, an upper GI cancer. Upper GI cancer is much more heterogeneous in terms of their expression level. For colon cancer, if it's HER2 positive, it's usually strongly HER2 positive and fairly homogeneous. So that is a biological difference between, say, an upper GI tract and a lower GI tract colon cancer.
So where today this is really relevant is in obviously in metastatic disease. We ask the faculty when they start thinking about HER2 specific therapy. Most of them say second line. And in general, almost everybody is thinking about tucatinib, trastuzumab. A couple people bring up trastuzumab, pertuzumab that has been looked at as well with second-line therapy, in many cases being T-DXd, which is a very interesting, at least thing to me. We asked, what about if you have somebody who has both MSI-high and HER2, and everybody says they go with checkpoint first. We'll get to this next case in a second. But maybe you can talk a little bit about what data we have on HER2-targeted therapy, the Mountaineer study, where you see things heading, and what you think is relevant and what should be done today.
Well, first of all, in this particular scenario, if anyone ever finds a patient who has both HER2-positive and MSI-high metastatic colorectal cancer, I hope they'll submit it as a case report. MSI-high disease is notorious for having frame shift mutations, but you would not typically see amplifications at all in an MSI-high cancer. So I personally have never seen a case of HER2-positive and MSI-high disease. So that's that. Thankfully, we don't have this scenario come up that much. But in terms of what we've got in the clinic now, we do have several chemotherapy-free regimens that demonstrate high response rate and favorable tolerability. And tucatinib trastuzumab is our only FDA-approved options, but there are other options listed in NCCN. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is really interesting because that's, of course, this antibody trastuzumab paired to a potent conjugate deruxtecan. And what's nice about trastuzumab deruxtecan is it retains similar activity whether or not that patient has failed prior anti-HER2 therapy. So what you're seeing here from all the advisors is that everybody's holding trastuzumab deruxtecan back, even though it still has a high response rate and a high PFS. And the reason is because you're keeping your options open. Patients who progress on trastuzumab-based therapy, by and large, do pretty well on trastuzumab deruxtecan. But that the reverse is not well established. And there is some concern that mechanisms of resistance to trastuzumab deruxtecan would not be favorable to one of these selective targeted combinations.
On top of that, of course, you have the issue of ILD with T-DXd, which, although uncommon, is a concern for a lot of people. What about the tolerability of tucatinib trastuzumab? You know, in breast cancer, they have the HER-CLIMB regimen. They add capecitabine to it, which, you know, adds a considerable amount of tolerability issues. What about just tucatinib trastuzumab? What do you see?
Well, you know, this was a trial that started as an investigator-initiated, investigator-sponsored trial. And, you know, when I thought about this trial and what I wanted to accomplish with this, this is taking a group of patients that are heavily beat up already by first and second line chemotherapy. So a regimen that's very well tolerated that you could give to somebody who's maybe just finished 2 years straight of chemo and put it on and have that patient tolerate therapy, get their performance status back. And I think the concern with putting capecitabine in is I don't think it would have helped the response rate very much, and it certainly would have made it more difficult to tolerate. And thankfully, the hope was realized in that trial in that some patients stay on this regimen for literally years and report excellent quality of life. I've had patients' spouses come to me and say, you know, hey, I got my husband back with this. And even when patients maybe develop progression in one or two sites, most patients will want to continue on this regimen, maybe ablate the progressing lesion and stay on because their quality of life is so much better on tucatinib trastuzumab than it was prior on cytotoxic chemotherapy. So this is really meant as a quality of life regimen for our patients.
You mentioned the idea of the first line trial, which really sounds great. I mean, the sooner that thing gets done, the better. It makes so much sense. Any other trial concepts being looked at with tucatinib that you're interested in?
Yeah, so tucatinib and trastuzumab is FDA approved for patients who have RAS wild type HER2 positive metastatic colorectal cancer. And the reason for that is those RAS mutations would probably drive rapid resistance to an anti-HER2 regimen like tucatinib and trastuzumab. So I have a trial that I'd like to launch soon that where we put TAS-102 together with tucatinib and trastuzumab for those patients who have a RAS mutation, where you need a cytotoxic around to provide some more control over that tumor that's likely to develop rapid resistance.
That sounds cool. TAS-102 plus MOUNTAINEER sounds interesting just to start with. I would imagine it would be pretty well tolerated. Nicholas in the chat room wants to know, do you re-biopsy when you're going to second-line therapy? Again, checking HER2, do you do a liquid biopsy? And I want to know, if they start out positive and liquid biopsy is negative, do you not use HER2 therapy?
Yeah, well, let's start with your question. Liquid biopsies are very helpful. If it's positive, you can trust it. You can believe it. The patient is likely to benefit from an anti-HER2 regimen. If it's negative, you have to be careful because there are a lot of reasons why a liquid biopsy might be negative for HER2, but that patient still has HER2 positive disease. You actually need pretty high tumor fraction to detect a HER2 amplification in blood. So be careful of the negatives, but the positives I think you can go with. In terms of, you know, if you put a patient on an anti-HER2 regimen and they progress, would I consider some type of repeat biopsy? I do think that's a good scenario for an anti, I think that is a good scenario for circulating tumor DNA. What I'm looking for on, say, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, or one of these selective regimens is the acquisition of some resistance mutation, PIK3CA, KRAS, NRAS, BRAF, something that caused that resistance. There is some small data that came out of DESTINY-CRC01 that trastuzumab deruxtecan is still active in these patients. that have maybe a little bit of KRAS floating around in their blood and is still HER2 positive.
So we're talking about TAS-102, and I want you to take a look at this next case. A patient of Dr. Rudolph was in the chat room, just asked that question before about the ctDNA. 58-year-old man, metastatic disease, status post multiple lines of chemotherapy. And what seems like the age-old question, which is what's next, and particularly the issue of regorafenib, TAS-102, sort of the post-initial chemo decisions. Here's Dr. Rudolph.
I keep asking myself, and knowing that he's progressing on this chemotherapy, whether we should try and switch him over to regorafenib or TAS-102. The few situations that I have used it in the past, patients have just right along progressed within 3 or 4 months. I'm curious to know what investigators would do in this situation. I'd love to know if investigators have found one better than the other and if there's a particular sequence in which they prefer.
How about TAS-102 combined with bevacizumab?
TAS-102 along with Bev. I have not used it. There was recent data suggesting efficacy, but I have not used it and would love to know if that is something they would recommend with better efficacy.
So any thoughts, again, about this question that's going back and forth for quite a few years? What comes first? How do you dose the regorafenib? We have a bunch of things that we ask the faculty, but maybe you can just tell us your clinical approach.
Yeah, certainly before we had the Sunlight trial, so when our options were really just TAS-102 or regorafenib, we generally consider the clinical benefit to be comparable between those two agents. So then you're making that decision based on the patient in front of you. Understanding that regorafenib is a multi-kinase inhibitor, anti-VEGF properties. TAS-102 is a cytotoxic chemotherapy with more myelosuppressive properties. And then you're matching up the therapy to the patient, what you think they can handle. The recent Sunlight data is very interesting in that it shows that when bevacizumab is added to TAS-102, we can substantially improve the progression-free survival and overall survival of TAS-102. So that's fairly influential, and I think you say that in the advisor responses to the question. It is notably higher PFS and survival. So that does look like the favored regimen if you feel like the patient is a candidate for more cytotoxic chemotherapy.
Have you seen, patients have, useful, reasonable duration of responses where they, got symptomatic improvement from either TAS-102/Bev or regorafenib?
I have. We recognize that these therapies do not generate high response rates, that the median progression-free survival is quite short. So I think Dr. Rudolph's experience is very much compatible with the evidence. Normally, when I'm giving somebody regorafenib or TAS-102, I tell the patient, our goal here is to hold this cancer back. But usually when you start that, you're preparing for what's next after that 2 to 4 month period of time of control. But the goal is control with those.
So let's take a look at the faculty's approach. We said, how are you sequencing thing? Before the Sunlight trial, we've got variation of answers, but you can see this is the way we do our consensus conference. So everybody says the same thing. We call it a consensus. Everybody's on board with starting at the lower dose of regorafenib, and everybody's using TAS-102 as a phase 3 trial. It's actually surprisingly positive results. Mm-hmm. It's in the slide deck, but like I said, I've got a feeling we're not going to get there. I'm going to just kind of skip this scenario because I want to hear what you think about this case of Dr. Gupta. Not only does this patient with metastatic rectal adenocarcinoma status post a bunch of therapies have a KRAS G12C mutation, but also high TMB on liquid biopsy. I think it was 31. Here's Dr. Gupta.
I did peripheral blood genomic analysis on him and found a lot of alterations. So he had KRAS G12C, KRAS G12V, and Q61H. I don't know. I know G12C is druggable. He had CHEK2 copy number loss. He also had EGFR amplification, and TMB was high at 31. A patient has agreed and just started on immunotherapy, and I'm hoping that he responds to it. I was just wondering, first of all, you know, how much credence to pay to all these alterations noted on peripheral blood? Which ones are driver mutations? Which ones are not? And how to pick your therapy based on that? Would sotorasib be a better treatment for him? Or should, you know, immunotherapy be chosen first because he's TMB high? So all of a sudden from hospice discussions, we are talking about treatment and treatment options, at least two of those in my book.
And that is Medical Oncology 2023. One thing before you comment on this, one of the docs recently when they were presenting these cases brought up the issue of, I guess, sort of false positive TMB on liquid biopsy. The fact that the TMB of 10 and all was done with tissue. And I never heard this before, but the TMB when you do liquid is higher. And I don't know whether how high it needs to be on liquid. Any comment about that first?
Yeah. So it's important to recognize the limitations of all of the assays we use. One of the limitations of blood is that they set the tumor mutational burden not off of some international standard. It's based on their own bioinformatic pipeline at that company. The numbers, if you lined up tissue and blood, there would be very limited correlation. And typically a TMB of, 16 to 20 in blood would be much lower in tissue. So we have to be careful over-interpreting a blood TMB result because there may be a number of sources for that tumor mutational burden beyond the tumor itself that could kind of contaminate that result.
I mean, I can understand why somebody would lean toward an IO versus, attacking KRAS G12C. You know, hopefully maybe you could, get lucky and have a home run. But just out of curiosity, based on what you've heard, do you think you would have used an IO here or would you try to target KRAS?
Well, there's a few things. So as I said, I also am involved in the molecular tumor board here at my institution. There's a few things that strike me about that report. The first is it is extremely unusual to see the absence of a TP53 mutation and an APC mutation in a report. And at least maybe there's more alterations and there's a second page to the report that I'm not seeing, but the absence of TP53 and APC out of that report suggests to me that there's that these mutations we're seeing may not even be coming from the tumor itself. So remember, the circulating tumor DNA is just picking up mutated DNA. It's not saying that's coming from the tumor, right? In a 78-year-old, there is a pretty high pretest probability that that patient has some type of mutation that is apparent in white blood cells. We call this clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential. So when we read this report and we see a KRAS G12C, we don't know that that came from the tumor itself. It could come from a white blood cell that contaminates our findings. So we need to be careful about how much credence we put into that report. It would be important to have the original tissue report for us to put the report side by side. Also, this is a profile, if this did come from the tumor, this is a classic profile for somebody who has RAS wild type disease that develops these RAS mutations as outgrowth for acquired resistance to anti-EGFR therapies. And I know we didn't have time in this case to present all the background, but if this did come from the tumor, I suspect it's a situation of acquired resistance to an anti-EGFR therapy.
I've always wanted to do a national tumor board where international or anybody could send in a case, and this would be a great case. I mean, not everybody has a molecular tumor board available. Just kind of curious what your take is in general on KRAS G12C. Interestingly, we asked which KRAS inhibitor would you likely prefer to use. Everybody except you says adagrasib. You were telling me before we started you've had a lot of experience with sotorasib that has been very positive, which I guess drives your choice.
Yeah, so we've been involved with the clinical studies around sotorasib here at our site. And I have very good personal experience with the agent. I know the data for adagrasib is outstanding and there's evidence that's been published in New England Journal for adagrasib with and without cetuximab. But based on my very favorable personal experience with sotorasib, I would be comfortable using that in this case.
Have you seen patients have, you know, significant responses that last a long time and, you know, do well quality life-wise?
Absolutely. We see durable responses to sotorasib by itself in lung cancer. The more recent evidence we have for both adagrasib and sotorasib is in combination with anti-EGFR therapy. And there you do see some cases of long-term responses with very good quality of life in many cases.
And you were telling me again before we got started that you've actually been able to access EGFR antibody plus one of these agents, I guess sotorasib in your case. It's interesting that you're able to do that and that you've seen these kinds of responses. Most people are saying second or third line. You say third line or beyond. Any comment on that?
Yeah, essentially what I was responding to here is the question about single agent sotorasib or adagrasib. And I think when you look at the response rate and the PFS, it looks like that would support a third line and beyond indication. So that's why I chose that setting.
So here's another case I was referring to it before. This is a patient of Dr. Ranju Gupta, a 61-year-old man with rectal cancer and synchronous liver mets, status post Fulfox and resection of the primary and liver mets, now has lung oligomets and actually just had surgery. Here's Dr. Gupta.
He had an extremely poor tolerance to Fulfox, the oxaliplatin. He's an auto mechanic, and with oxaliplatin and cold sensitivity and the neuropathy, it was impossible for him to work. And then last year in November, on surveillance scans, developed solitary lung mets. We just had the resection done. So my question here, and I think this question is not after lung resection, but in general, we always discuss them in our tumor boards. Once we have these localized oligometastatic disease and we have done a resection on this patient, should I just observe him or should I give him some treatment, maybe 3 months, 6 months? And if yes for treatment, what kind of treatment?
Yeah, particularly in view of the fact of how much problems he had with the Fulfox.
So in a setting where somebody's already received a full course of perioperative Fulfox and the patient no longer has evidence of disease, so no evidence of disease after this second resection, we would not recommend additional chemotherapy. There's just no evidence of survival benefit for this patient.
So I want to go back. Actually, by mistake, I skipped over this one from the last thing. We were talking about EGFR antibodies with these KRAS G12C inhibitors. But I also was curious, and I get a lot of questions from oncologists about that, about repeating, re-challenging with an EGFR antibody and a patient has previously received it. You know, for example, if the patient had a prior response, and particularly the issue of looking at ctDNA in that setting for, quote, resistance mutations, which, again, pretty much all the faculty are open to that possibility. Have you tried that strategy with the rechallenge? And any thoughts about this scenario?
Yeah, so data out of Italy suggests that patients who have no RAS mutations at blood at the time of rechallenge have up to a 30% response rate and clearly benefit more than those patients who have maybe RAS mutations detected in blood. So I would consider in that scenario, the open question is whether that patient would benefit more from rechallenge than, say, our standard of care, which would be TAS-102 or regorafenib. And that question has not been answered yet.
So we had a couple of nice cases of BRAF V600E. We'll maybe get to them in the next program in this series. But I just want to get your thoughts about the faculty's approach to BRAF mutant disease. In terms of targeted therapy, everybody seems to be oriented around second-line treatment. Mm-hmm. Everybody seems to be oriented around encorafenib plus EGFR antibody. Mm-hmm. Any comments about these practices? And also how you find tolerability with encorafenib cetuximab?
Yeah, I think that encorafenib and anti-EGFR combination is in general well tolerated. We see very good response rate, substantially better response rate than, say, with standard cytotoxic chemotherapy. When we do see toxicity from this. It may be a rash, it may be arthralgias, but it's generally manageable. And I think patients are well served to receive this highly active therapy second line rather than waiting till third line.
So, John, it was really great to work with you today. Audience, thank you so much for attending. Come on back Sunday morning. We'll hear some debate about ovarian cancer. We got a case of a patient with a recurrent disease who had a 5-year response to PARP inhibitor. Now that strategy has been thrown out by the FDA. We'll see what the faculty thinks about that. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.